program is being brought to you on the Seventh Wave Network. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit SeventhWaveNetwork.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Well, welcome everyone. This is Randall Libero, and welcome to Spirit of Film Conversations on the Seventh Wave Network channel. As you know, movies and media are changing the way we think, live, relate, and dream. So each week we talk to media pioneers and also showcase today's independent and visionary filmmakers whose movies evoke what I call the spirit of film, which is a metaphor for the movie's magical power to transform our lives. And today we're going to start talking about the internet and media on the internet this summer. And we begin this series with an extremely controversial documentary. You probably have seen this documentary if you've been on the internet for a number of years watching movies, especially on YouTube. It's a film called Zeitgeist, and it also has a sequel called Zeitgeist Addendum. And these two films are the creation of writer, producer, director Peter Joseph, and Peter is with us today on the line, and he is with us for the entire hour, and we'll be taking your phone calls in the second part of today's show. Peter, welcome to the program. How are you?
Thank you, Randall. I appreciate you having me on. I'm well.
Well, when you're a commercial director in New York, I understand, and you did this first Zeitgeist film as sort of a way to express what you were seeing happening on the planet. And also, you loaded it up, like many of us filmmakers do, on YouTube. And when did you begin realizing that your film was getting a lot of views and starting to have an impact?
Well, I suppose when I watched that Google counter start to rise exponentially, and then after creating a very basic website for the film, which, by the way, was never intended to be a released film at all. It was actually a private creation that was displayed for an activist community in Lower Manhattan, something that not too many people seem to know. It was never intended to be released to the public at all. But nevertheless, I had this website that I created, and I started getting a flood of emails. And then at that point, I knew that, A, I was causing some interest, and, B, I was probably in a lot of trouble. So I had to retroactively go back and get rights clearances for that film, which was an absolute nightmare, as you can imagine. But nevertheless, once that thing got online, I don't know how it triggered, but I think it might have started with some Patriot blogs or what have you. But it's fascinating to see the evolution of it, that's for sure.
Well, the movie kind of asks us to see through the what I would call the real Matrix, referring to the Matrix film, of today's ruling power elite. And it says that this elite group has controlled human society by voicing belief systems. And these belief systems keep people disempowered, and they have to do with both governments and organized religions. Your film, it's almost an education, kind of explaining to people, looking at religion, the event of September 11th, and the economic system. How did you first conceive of the material that you would include in the film? What were some of your ideas that you were considering that you didn't do, or how did you actually come up with the idea to construct the film in the form that it is now? I'm talking about the first movie.
Well, originally the production was going to be gestural. It wasn't supposed to be a documentary. And as I was creating this production, I realized that I began to learn many different aspects, many different things that I hadn't researched thoroughly. And I realized that I had an obligation based on what I'd understood and the fact that this information wasn't really out there, that I should incorporate it into a larger form, which basically comprised the documentary. And religion was always interesting to me. I've always studied comparative religions. I was never particularly religious, but nevertheless, it's fascinating to see psychology, and hence the sociology behind religious belief and how it parallels and relates and how it offshoots in the general conduct of society, of the individual, and of course society as a whole. But so that was my initial trigger, and then once I got to that point, I was making this small little thing on religion, trying to be gestural still, and then slowly deviating away from that and ended up in a full documentary. Along that course, I stumbled upon 9/11, which, like everybody else, I believe for many years, the official story, and then I started to stumble upon information that contradicted it, so I looked at it with great cynicism, and the more I learned, the more the scale started to weigh out, and probabilistically speaking, which of course is the way we have to view everything, there's no way the government story can hold any type of water. So that's how that originated. I made the connection between religion and 9/11 because it's faith. Patriotism and nationalism, these are faith-based issues, just like Christianity or Judaism or Islam. People have these associations that they've created in their minds. It's been conditioned into them by what you call the elite. What I call the elite is probably a little bit different from what most people refer to. A lot of people have a hyper-conspiratorial obsession with the elite these days. They see them as this set group. And it really isn't. It's an evolution of people that are perpetually in power. And because they're in power, because they keep becoming into power, because the behavioral patterns that they have been conditioned to perpetuate gains them entrance into positions of power, they in turn are forced to get everybody in the society to think virtually the same way, because that's how you maintain a state, that's how you maintain a belief system. So it's the perpetuation of belief systems that keeps society as we know it in order. If they didn't do this, if they didn't have the mass brainwashing, you'd see a very, very different society. In fact, you'd see a very chaotic society. It has a strange point. The interesting thing to me is that ultimately all societies have to share a value system in order for it to be a society. The question is, what is the value of that value system? Sorry to sound redundant. What is the effect of that value system? How does it benefit society, or does it just simply oppress them? And unfortunately, we've been living through endless generations of oppression by ruling classes, and there's many psychological and sociological and environmental reasons for that I'm not going to jump into right now. But that was the issue when it came to patriotism and 9/11 and, of course, religion. And then in the third section, I deviate more dramatically. I go into many different points, such as war and the banking system and the income tax and many things that people also simply buy wholesale. And they believe, I think war would fall in the same category as nationalistic belief. People think war is just a natural thing. It's something that, you know, we'll just keep having. It's some human nature, perhaps, they might claim. And the fact is, war is done for profit more than anything else at this point. The last real war the United States needed to engage in was, of course, the Revolutionary War. That was about it. I'm not saying that retroactively it wasn't a good thing that we did go into World War II because of Hitler and all that, but hindsight is very different. You know, when it comes to motivation, when it comes to the core interests, the profit-based interests of war, it's quite disgusting that the majority of society can't see through this, and we still tolerate our established governments to engage in this, the highest echelon of corruption. So that's basically the evolution. The evolution is based on the belief system of society as imposed by the so-called elite, or whatever you want to call it, as opposed by those in the ruling class that have the power to perpetuate their value systems, or in other words, the value systems that they require to maintain in power. That's why you turn on the television, you see violence and greed and all of this, all the most social distortions that you can think of are perpetuated in this system. And because they've been perpetuated for so long, people think it's actually the way we are, and it's not. We're conditioned organisms, and that's one of the most profound things to realize. So to make all this, to cut this short, what I would have to say is that in order to alter this pattern, you have to begin to instill a different value system, and it can't come from the state, it can't come from religion, it has to come from something much more tangible, and that's why I talk about science and technology in the new film, and I deviate away from the so-called controversial conspiratorial notions that people, at least that's what they peg in category. So I hope that clarifies.
Yeah, it does. Well, one of the things I always advise people to do when they, especially when they're watching the news on television, is to look beyond exactly what you're being told. I mean, the face value of news today is absolutely ridiculous. I mean, I worked in it for 12 years. I wrote for both WorldNet, the U.S. State Department, in the propaganda branch called the U.S. Information Agency, and then for CBS, for their news browser for almost 5 years. So I remember on September 11th that I could sense something didn't add up, especially, you know, when I was covering the supposed plane crash, quote unquote, at the Pentagon, and there wasn't any plane. I'm going, well, where are the people? What's going on here? And so I started looking into what happened before. And so the amazing thing about news and history is that everything has a pattern. And in your film, you really pointed out the patterns of not only, you know, the beginnings of the situation that we're in today, and giving the historical perspective all the way back to the time of like Andrew Jackson and his presidency and what happened in 1913, which is the creation of the Federal Reserve and the income tax and all that. And it's really good for people to maintain a perspective and looking at current events, because there's always historical precedents. Would you agree that that's probably a good barometer of understanding what's happening today?
Oh, absolutely. If people don't know their history, they don't know where they're coming from, and therefore they have no sense of relationship to the modern world. People definitely need to understand historical patterns by all means. Otherwise, you know, there's a reason why certain things are omitted from college textbooks that should very much be there. You know, I'm sure you've read The People's History of the United States. These are important books that everyone should be reading to understand that history does repeat itself, because there's only so many variations that could occur. And so once you realize that there are three other instances of false flag terrorism, and basically all get navigated towards war, and then once you realize that the banking system, then 9/11 happened, and it was the exact same pattern, exactly the same thing happened. Mm-hmm. And then once you realize the banking system has been long abhorred by almost every so-called free country since the dawn of civilization, the money changers, you know, it goes back even to the Bible. The Bible denotes these gestures as well. And, of course, most people don't see that either. Most have no idea what money is, where it comes from, who organizes it, and not only the structural ramifications of it as far as this so-called free market that we have, but the psychological ramifications of keeping people at war with each other, and that's exactly what is generated in our current system. There's very little collaboration. It's all competition, and unfortunately, most people are still brainwashed enough to believe that that's the way things should be. And so anyway, to answer your question, absolutely. But the history is very important, and if people don't understand history, they really have no frame of reference.
Well, just to give some perspective, in your original film, Zeitgeist, you talk about the events leading up to September 11th, and then I'm going to get off the subject and cover. I want to get into what's in addendum more than anything, but I want to give people, since we're talking about history, one of the things that you mentioned that people can still see in the news today is actually the growth of the opium industry in Afghanistan. And how, when the opium industry, which was non-existent in Afghanistan before, didn't happen, wasn't happening, but it was introduced there, and as soon as the production levels dropped almost down to zero, is exactly the time when we started looking at, you know, a military option. We put a military option on the table. Matter of fact, you make a point in the film that that it actually, you know, it dropped so significantly that by, you know, September 9th, that the invasion plans were on Bush's desk of 2001, and that was just a few days before. And one of the things that I found was interesting, looking at history, if anyone knows history in Afghanistan, that the Russians invaded Afghanistan in the late 70s, and they tried to take it over. And so we financed the Northern American the guys, the Northern Alliance who were fighting the Soviets, who were led by Ahmed Massoud. Now, I found it really interesting that 2 days before September 11th, that Massoud was assassinated.
Yes, that's right.
And 2 days before. So here's the guy who knows what's been going on militarily in Afghanistan. And 2 days before, two guys with bombs strapped to their body, posing as reporters, blow themselves up in his presence and kill him. Well, he's the one person who could basically put a dent in our invasion plans in Afghanistan. Convenient, isn't it? So all you have to do is go back and check these kinds of things and look at this stuff, and there is the pattern for you. So I just wanted to make that point talking about September 11th. So this
Absolutely. I mean, if you add up the benefit of what the September 11th excuse has provided, the benefit, it's unbelievable. When you look at it again in hindsight, of course, is always 20/20. You ask most people today, why are we in Afghanistan? And they'll probably look at you blankly and then say something about terrorism, because they don't know. I mean, because it's obvious, it's something that much more covert than anything they're telling the public. And yes, it most likely has everything to do with drug running and, of course, oil. I mean, if I remember correctly, the appointed so-called prime minister or president or whatever of Afghanistan was from the oil company Unocal, which I find absolutely hilarious. But nevertheless, you know, I hope that people do recognize that and they see the transparency of this. And as you said, they need to see the pattern of how we get into war. That's why I'm always terrified when I turn on the news and I see these things about North Korea and China. We're just sitting there taunting these people. We're taunting these countries. And I'm just waiting for something to snap, because it can happen overnight. You know, there's so many nuclear warheads on this planet. That's for a different subject, but people really need to be more aware, because I'm terrified what can happen. The next major conflict, I think, is especially with the economic collapse. If you look at history again, major economic collapses often lead to intercontinental warfare. And this happened in the Second World War. This is in many instances of this. And usually war brings out a bad economy. That's not happening right now with our current wars. The industries are not, they can't funnel enough labor to get, you know, to get everyone stirred and riled up in order to improve the economic scenario with the unemployment and everything else. It's not working. So I'm very curious to see what happens with all this. But anyway, we can talk about that.
Right. So, like I said, it's just really, if you understand your history and the patterning and everything, the whole rise of Hitler and all that. I mean, as you went through all that in the film, and actually, I think you covered it pretty well. Let's talk about Zeitgeist Addendum. Now, I met John Perkins back in 1995, and when he was mostly, you know, talking about spiritual matters and shamanism. And then a few years later, he came out with his book called Confessions of an Economic Hitman, and you do a pretty extensive interview with him in that movie. He really outlined the process of which we basically create instability in a country in order to take it over and basically further our American interests internationally. And so it's really helpful for people to understand the steps at which we go through, which is basically we send an economic hitman in. If that doesn't work in a country, we send in what John Perkins called the jackals, which are all the CIA operatives, and they look to destabilize it and so forth. And then if that doesn't work, we do a military option with sanctions, like exactly what happened with Iraq. And so it again, we're looking at the patterns of things, and this has happened before. Now, one of the things that I see, what do you think is going to happen with Iran? Because one of the examples that John Perkins uses is in Iran when we destabilized Iran and put the Shah in power, and then of course with Saddam Hussein, and then we had to go in and take him out because he wasn't following the way we wanted him to follow. Do you think that Iran is potentially a point of transition for this whole system? I've heard it referred to by a few people before that it will really bring down this whole corporatocracy that's going on because of the alliances that Iran has with especially Russia and I think Venezuela and so forth.
Well, I think there'll be that's a very interesting point. We'll have to wait and see on that. I'm not quite sure. I mean, there's a lot of alliances happening, that's for sure, but there's also a lot of tricks up the sleeves of Western intelligence. I really couldn't tell you. I have no idea as far as that. Iran is interesting. I'm much more concerned about China and Korea, North Korea. China specifically, since China holds so much government debt, and China is starting to print money like crazy. They're getting hit pretty badly with the same economic problems. So when China starts calling in its bonds and wants its money, I don't know what could happen with that. They're a much more powerful institution, and they threaten the empire of the United States as well. So I again, this is speculative, and I don't like to really talk about stuff that's too speculative, but nevertheless, Iran isn't my biggest concern. I hope they do continue good alliances. If I remember correctly, they changed the bourse, and they use the euro now for oil, if I remember correctly, and that's exactly what Iraq did before we went in. So that's that's very interesting to see those patterns. You know, the United States dollar, I'm sure most know, is really backed by oil. That's about the only thing that keeps our dollar going. It's the petrodollar, or at least it used to be. It's slowly not being. But, you know, nevertheless, I really couldn't give too much speculation on that. There's so many different things that come up that lead me one way or another. You see the saber rattling for Iran periodically. And I notice that it happens under, kind of behind the scenes. No one, Obama doesn't talk about it, really. It's something much more covert that's in charge of all of these operations. And you know, we'll just have to wait and see. But I'm much more concerned about China than anything else.
Your films have spurned a movement called the Zeitgeist Movement. You can find it online, thezeitgeistmovement.com, and the links are on my site at spiritoffilm.net. And you did an event where you had a lot of people show up, and you did a presentation and so forth, and you even got some coverage by the New York Times, and I have the article linked on my site as well. What was your sense of how the media was responding to the whole concept of Zeitgeist?
Well, I was surprised to get any type of review, let alone by the Times, let alone relatively neutral. The you know, the media doesn't want to touch any of these topics, and especially the biggest taboo I've noticed is when you go after the monetary system and the free market, because that's another religion, basically. You know, we have all of our priests, the Milton Friedmans, you know, the Chicago and Austrian schools. And these, what's been perpetuated on the people in this regard is truly incredible. I don't want to jump off on that tangent, but I think it's incredible how many people, you know, were willing to report on the first film, usually negatively, but very few people in the press have chosen to report on Addendum directly. The New York Times report was about the event. He didn't go into too much detail about the film, even though it was, you know, definitely suggestive. But, you know, I've seen very little press on Addendum overall, and I think the reason is because it's a different form of taboo. They're not willing to look at the logic behind what we're attempting to explain, and the few articles that have been written, usually by third-party press representatives, meaning independent websites, they have absolutely bashed it, referring it to as being communistic, you know, all the cliches that you could think of in regards to people that are only in support of free market capitalism. So I think that's part of it. So to answer your question, you know, I don't take the press that seriously anymore. I was amazed that the New York Times even did what they did, and hopefully the next event I do, they'll cover as well. The reporters seem to be very, very, you know, balanced and interested, nevertheless. So, you know, we'll see what happens. But no, I haven't gotten hardly any real significant press. In other countries, they have. We've had the Greece movement. The movement has definitely grown, and in certain countries, we've gotten a lot more press, especially press for the Venus Project directly. So, you know, in America, I really don't take it too seriously. I'm much more interested and much more excited to get international press, to be frank, because when it comes down to what we're doing, America is going to be the last to fall in line. It's far too corrupt. So.
Well, in Zeitgeist Addendum, the latter part of the film, you talk about a different kind of future that we can imagine, and you interview an amazing visionary architect by the name of Jacques Fresco. You mentioned the Venus Project. And if anyone wants to get a little bit more background information besides the Zeitgeist Addendum film, I interviewed documentary filmmaker William Gusecki back in April of 2008, and you can listen to the interview with William. And William actually created a film called Future by Design, and you can look that up on the internet. And it's a terrific documentary that goes into a lot of detail about Jacques Fresco and all his whole work, his whole vision for the future. And he's an amazing social architect as well as a architect of, you know, structure and design and so forth. What was your initial excitement when you met Jacques and started to really understand the implications of what he was kind of shooting for, and how did that kind of jive with your vision about how you wanted to allow people to kind of see through into a new possibility for the future?
Well, his ideas are extremely tangible and practical, and based on simply advanced knowledge that most people don't have, and I felt it was absolutely perfectly in line with my general foundation of activism, so to speak. When I would talk about Zeitgeist after the first one came out, people kept asking me, you know, what do we do about this and that? And I'm saying, well, you have to begin to shift culture. You can't keep the value systems that we've had. And when I started to read about Jacques, you know, the one thing I know about Jacques is that he's not just an architectural designer or an engineer or an industrial designer. That's how he typically refer to himself. Everything he does is within a larger social context. He doesn't care about some structure that's self-sustaining. It all fits within a social idea, which is absolutely unified, and it's not a special interest type of thing, and it's not even very opinionated either, which is another interesting aspect about Jacques' work, which I found very influential, is when you talk to him about specific ideas and you break it down, while there's a tremendous amount of creativity, it all comes back to a central home base, and that is efficiency and productivity and sustainability. And if that's not the way to go, I don't know what is. So when I first heard about Jacques, you know, I saw him as a great inventor. I had no idea about his social designs. It wasn't until I met with him and got his book that I realized the magnitude of what he'd been working on his entire life. As you might know, he's about 93 years old now. And it completely turned me around. It regained my focus on what a direction should be. And at this point, I really can't see many alternatives. We live on a planet. The planet has a carrying capacity. We influence that carrying capacity with technological innovation. We have the ability, with the exponential growth of technology, to relieve humans of tremendous amounts of boring and monotonous labor. We can advance technology in ways that would make us live much longer, which would create incredible, sustainable societies. We're not talking about utopia, because we always are going to be emergent, we're always going to be changing, we're always going to be updating. But when you realize that today we have a monetary system that is parasitic and paralyzing, those are the two P's I would use. It's utterly parasitic because everyone is leeching off of each other. That's all anyone does. I mean, advertisers leech off of corporations. Corporations leech off of their employees, basically. The employees leech off the corporations in return. It's this constant battle of I can't even think of a word for it. It's a perpetual battle of parasitic behavior, and that's the entire system. There's no, the collaborative efforts are kind of a general product in hope when people are in competition and they work as teams against other teams. That's about the level of collaboration. You can't have the system without competition, which is an absolute social distortion, which really messes people up mentally on many different levels. Then there's the other P, the paralyzing. We have the absolute paralysis of society because institutions are created that generate money, that support people that are being employed, and if that institution becomes obsolete due to technological understanding or scientific innovation, are they just going to roll over and pass off their institution? Absolutely not. All I have to do is look at the oil companies. There's no reason to be burning the fossil fuels on this planet at all, period. Yet we still maintain this because it's a massive multi-billion dollar industry with heavy people at the top, of course, with a strong political confluence. And, of course, you have tons of people working for these organizations. And that's just a small aspect of it. So Jacques recognized this, and I never really fully thought about the psychological implications of the monetary system the way Jacques did. And that was one of the core realizations for me. People look at each other with a great deal of suspicion in our culture. You know, we can't be altruistic. We can't be uncorrupt. Every human being in this culture, on this planet, is inherently corrupt, period. You have to be corrupt. Corrupt means dishonest. You have to be corrupt because you wouldn't be able to function otherwise. It's all about competing corrupt strategies, the gaming mentality that exists in our current culture. And the greatest realization is that based on technological understanding now, if we simply work together as a society and or most idealistically as a planet with the resources, with the sharing of ideas, we could create an incredible world that is absolutely absent of all of the problems we see that's been generated by scarcity, such as war, you know, the absolute corruption of all governments on the planet, the meaningless banking institutions. So it's cooperation that we have to evolve into, not competition. And, of course, back to my original point about the free market, boom, you say something like that, you're just a collectivist, and you like Mao and Stalin, and you hang out at the gulag. They love to label you because that's what the religion perpetuates, this free market nonsense that people have in their brains. It had a place in history, I'll grant you that, but now it's not relevant whatsoever. So it's my hope that with this movement we can begin to make this transition into what Jacques refers to as a resource-based economy. I hope that helps.
Yeah, sure. One of the points that Jacques makes is that our problems in life are technical and they're not political, and therefore politicians can't solve them, which I think is a terrific point to make for people. And politicians don't know how to solve problems. They know how to create laws, and he makes a point where he says, if you have something that isn't working, well, you can make a law to stop people behaving in that manner, or you can solve the problem technically and eliminate it. And I think that's a really important point for people to understand, basically to apply technology in a way that's going to make something function better, make our lives better.
Go ahead.
The other point that I want to bring up is that as we stay in terms of this aspect of we're constantly in competition with each other, it also promotes the illusion of separation from the natural world around us. And I think that the growth in terms of spiritual longing over the past, say, 40 or 50 years or so, I think is a backlash against this whole thing that's happening right now. People want more meaning. I mean, that's one of the reasons why I started the Seventh Wave channel, because people want something to reflect back to them what they're sensing inwardly. So people really know that what they see happening is there's an aspect of, you know, it's mystifying. They don't understand why things are going on. So if we just check in inwardly and use our discernment when we watch things, especially on the news on television, I've said this many times in this program, I think if people can do that, they'll begin to see through this matrix and know that the kind of things that are in your movie, and they want to look deeper. That's one of the ways that so everyone can educate themselves, so they're not reacting constantly to what we're being told in the news and media and everything else. So that part of checking in inwardly, I think, is a big aspect of that. Is that part of some of the materials that you have in your Zeitgeist Movement information for people to do?
As far as the kind of introspection type of idea?
Yeah,
well, absolutely. One thing I say, though, is that it's not isolated. I used to kind of be a little more gestural than I am now. I've grown a little more literal. But I mean that in the sense that there's a lot of kind of I hate to say mysticism, but I used to read a lot of Jiddu Krishnamurti. He's a brilliant mind, and he talked about the crisis of consciousness, and he talks about constantly this need to understand yourself, to understand how you affect things, understand how the world affects you. And but he had a very internal aspect to it, and I could never quite get beyond his notion of consciousness in regard to it all coming from within. Because what I've come to realize is that to really understand yourself, you have to kind of understand the world that created you. You know, every word that comes out of my mouth is taught to me. Every concept that I present has been inferentially organized based on prior information that's been given to me or that I've accumulated in some way through experience. In the way I walk, my mannerisms, my speech patterns, it's a conditioning of the environment, so we're not separated whatsoever. So whenever I meet people that, and I'm not saying you're denoting this, but I do get this a lot with people that are I can't think of a way to describe it. I say mysticism in the sense that they think it's all internal, you know, like they heavy meditation. That's good. That's really good to center yourself and understand yourself as best you can. But the only way you can really do that fully, if there was such a thing, is to understand the environment that's created you. And that's a very important topic in the movement. We do talk about conditioning a whole lot. And I think that's really the crutch of the whole thing. You know, it's obvious that human beings can be conditioned to do just about anything. I mean, you look at Jim Jones, you look at Charles Manson, you look at what you see on television, you look at the stuff that people are fed in reality shows. How many disgusting shows can there possibly be on television, like Are You Hot? I mean, they impose these value systems on people and make them feel insecure and inferior so they can sell products to them and basically groom people to be consumers in the style that's most beneficial to the advertising agency that's promoting whatever is being promoted. So that's definitely a big aspect of it. I mean, I think spirituality is, it's the term spirituality really has to do with connection to me. That's how I find a general definition. That's one of those semantic words, you know, that is all over the place. But I find a spiritual connection to everything because I realize that very literally I'm intimately connected. I'm being changed every second of every moment, and I'm taking in new information. I'm on the phone right now talking to you. I'm absorbing new information. So there's an obvious connection that's not mystical. It's definitely spiritual, if you want to give it that type of term. But it's it comes down to conditioning. So I think that's how I would describe that to you. As regard to your first point about philosophy, you had mentioned that Jacques talked about root causes, how you don't put up a sign that says 55 miles per hour. You create a system that keeps people safe inherently. And this, of course, can be done. And not only is it relevant to technology, as you've denoted, it's a general philosophical principle. Like, for example, I use this example a lot, the cancer industry. What do? They constantly treat the problem, but they do not go after the root causes. You don't see anyone going after the causes of cancer with any type of valor. You know, we have a polluted system, we have insecticides used, we have tremendous amounts of detrimental environmental issues that are creating all of this cancer, yet no one's thinking that way. They want to make money by creating solutions. And the solutions, of course, are for another subject, but they cut off other treatments that are beneficial that the FDA can't patent. You know, these patterns have been in existence for a while. And my point is that the root causes are the most important thing. So if we want to understand the corruption of society, and this is, again, what Jacques has made me clearly aware of, if we want to stop the wars and stop the people that are constantly exploiting, you know, the government, the elite, so to speak, if you want to call them that, we have to change the source of that. And to me, the source really comes from the stratified monetary system that's based on scarcity. I mean, even the money supply is scarce in our current system, as we all know. You know, there's not enough money to go around. The interest that's created does not exist. So everyone is constantly scrounging around, trying to get out of debt, put in a position of servitude. They're angry at society. It's a very nasty psychological thing. And for us to stop all of the crime, to stop all of the issues that that most people traditionally don't like, we have to figure out what's causing it, not create more laws or build more prisons or get more police, which, of course, is all we're doing. I mean, every year, the prison population in America grows, I can't remember the percentage, but I'm sure you're aware of this. It's unbelievable. I mean, we have the largest prison population on the planet, and that would make sense because we're also the most capitalist, unsocialistic country on the planet, too. So that doesn't surprise me whatsoever. We breed this. Our society creates serial killers. It creates the elite. It creates the indifferent generals that will bomb a school with children in it. And the source, even though very difficult, needs to be addressed. And that's really the foundation of the movement more than anything else, I think.
Very much so. One of the solutions there's so many people that have come up with solutions for cancer. You can read a book called The China Study. That's a really good study that went over, I think, a 30 or 40-year period. And I think something really simple as removing chemicals from our food, but there's so much money being made on chemicals today. You know, I mean, just taking that out of the equation of our food system and stop eating processed foods. I mean, definitely people, you know, very simply get healthier just by doing that. Absolutely. So, I mean, there's all sorts of things that we all can do to empower ourselves, which I think is the point of your films for people to really look at and take self responsibility, which I think is a really terrific thing. In your movie, is going back to the point about spirituality, you actually use the word symbiosis or symbiotic. Can you explain a little bit more about what you mean by that?
Sure. I like the way Fresco put it in an interview I did with him. I don't think I put the full thing in the film, but I asked him his opinion on symbiosis, and he said, well, you know, we don't see the plug up our ass. And that's a great point. The interconnection of humans to nature is not only philosophical, which I can relate to, but it's absolutely tangible. You know, we have to have clean air and clean water and nutritious food to eat. We have to live in a culture that supports itself. We can't be in perpetual competition or it's going to create a negative retroaction. That's obviously what's been going on for generation after generation. So the symbiotic relationship is really quite clinical. It's, you have to realize that you're a part of a system. And then you can also look at it from a kind of a parallel standpoint. Like, I love the example Jacques uses where he explains the human organ system. And if your heart decided to go out for itself and go in a free market against your lungs and they compete for cells and blood, you know, you'd rot away. And it's time we look at society this way as well. It's time we realize that there's a symbiotic connection to each person in a society. For example, here's a good example. If a person is deprived on the street, I live in East Brooklyn, and I have a lot of poor people around me, and, you know, they're homeless and they want money. I try as much as I can to give, not because I expect him to get a lot of food out of it or anything, but because I'm planting a seed, because that person can eventually get angry, and they might turn around and rob me at a later date. We are responsible for everything that we see one way or another. Even though we might not have the power to make a holistic change, we can make some form of change, and that, of course, has to happen, and it's a start, and that's exactly what the movement's about. So my point is that you are responsible for the homeless people on the street because you're supporting the system that perpetuates it. Some guy who doesn't like the war but has to have a job, so he works in a munitions factory, he might have his family and kids he has to feed. He has to do what he has to do in order to feed his family, even though he's creating, helping a war industry that might use the munitions he's created to go and bomb some small village in the Middle East. So this is the type of symbiotic relationship of society that I didn't quite address in the film, but I think it's very important for people to realize. And until the system itself begins to recognize that and we have a larger structure that's actually designed, I use that word design because we don't have any design in our structure right now. It's a free-for-all. A society that's designed to support nature and humanity, to have respect for what we call the carrying capacity of the earth, which if people aren't familiar with that term, essentially means that in order for us to, like any kind of scientific adventure, any type of project, like you have a plot of land and you want to grow food on it, logically you would go and you would test the soil to see what nutrients are there, to see what the highest propensity what food has the highest propensity of growing there based on the nutrients. If there's rock masses, you know, if you want to build something, you have to examine what's there. And we haven't even done that on this planet. We don't even know what we have. All the corporations hold all the resources, so we don't even know what we can do. People say food is scarce. No, it's not. It's definitely not scarce based on the numbers that I've seen, not to mention technology is going to enable us to create much more food in many different ways where we don't even need arable land area, even though, of course, we do have to stop destroying the topsoil, which is eroding at about 1% a year. So excuse me from jumping around a bit, but the issue really comes down to relating to the environment as we know it very simply. And we're not even doing that. We've failed at step one. And until we collect ourselves and look at step one, we're going to maintain a real serious mess. I mean, one person dies of starvation on this planet every second. I think that's absolutely absurd. So.
Some of the points that you make in your film as far as when people ask about solutions, and I'm sure you get this all the time, you mention a handful of things, and one of them is to not have your money in certain banks, such as Citibank, Bank of America, J.P. Morgan Chase, to turn off the news and boycott the military. But I want to kind of go back, since this program is about media, go back to talking about the Internet. And the Internet is, I think, our last medium of free expression on this planet, where we can actually, you know, just like yourself as a filmmaker, you can put up a film online at Zeitgeist and get people to watch it, and there's nothing impeding that. What do you think are some of the things that people should be aware of about possible control of the Internet that's coming down from kind of these legal guys who want to start controlling it a little bit? What are some of the things that people should be aware of to help prevent this kind of thing happening?
Well, and generally speaking, just be aware of the introduction of any legislation. You know, we have the cybersecurity bill that was put forward. The Canadian government has a bill they're putting forward. Of course, the corporations are constantly lobbying to try and take the Internet and break it up and make it a subscription-based service, which will fall perfectly in line with the establishment, because then they can begin to make tiers of relevance, and then they can begin censorship. I'm sure many know that the cybersecurity bill that I believe was snuck through in one of Obama's stimulus packages. By the way, if anyone aren't aware of this, whenever they come out with a stimulus package, they always sneak through legislation, and no one hears about it. Something to look into. Very sneaky tactic that they do. But essentially, you know, in the time of some form of terrorist act, they can shut down the Internet at will. They can just literally pull the plug on the whole thing, say if they just don't want people communicating. Stuff like this is definitely coming to fruition, and people need to definitely be aware of it. And I'm in the movement. I talk about this, but I haven't had a chance to go straight focused on it because nothing's changed yet. But there's all this stuff out there that's lingering. And the positive thing to me is that the public loves the Internet. It's revolutionized everything from commerce to you know, Internet dating to anything. It's huge. And if they start to restrict it based on subscriptions, especially in our current economy, I don't think they're going to get away with it. I really don't think that the public is just going to roll over and allow, you know, these subscription services or allow the censorship. It's like the last bastion of freedom. The moment the U.S. starts doing that, the people are going to see the obvious parallel to, say, China, and they're going to get very upset. But be that as it may, unfortunately, the American public is extremely malleable. And in the event that they do have some massive legislation coming forward, I will definitely react with the people that are in association with me. And I'm sure I will not be alone. I think there will be many, many organizations out there that are interested in free speech that will come together. So I think the governments know that. I think they're aware of that. But it's definitely people need to pay attention to it, because it's not the kind of thing that hits mainstream news. You got to have to kind of search for that information. But I'm in 100% agreement with you. That's why in addendum I make that comment, you know, the Internet's the last bastion of hope. It's our savior, I think, was the term that I used. And yeah, it's definitely true, so we have to protect it.
What are going to be some of the things that you're going to be covering in Zeitgeist Part 3?
Zeitgeist Part 3 is going to take all the rhetoric from Zeitgeist 2, at least the second half of Zeitgeist Addendum, and it's going to systematically break it down and show the legitimacy of the concepts. Many people today have no sense of higher technology. They have no idea what we're capable of doing with automation. They have no idea the fact that real unemployment in this world is caused by technology, not by the ebb and flow of economies. The reason people are unemployed is because technological innovation. And the amazing thing is that we can actually produce more with less people, and this is statistically proven. So the selling of labor for income is on its way out. Whether it takes 10 years or whether it takes 50 years depends on the behavior of the species in regards to this phenomenon. Nevertheless, you're going to see a rise in unemployment perpetually, and that really is the pattern that you see globally. And it's due to technology more than anything else. So I'm going to talk about that. I'm going to talk about nanotechnology a little bit. I'm going to talk about a lot of different things that I don't want to go into too much detail, because I might say things that I might later not put in there. But another aspect of it is human behavior and this obsession, this what I would say religious obsession with what they call human instinct or human nature. And I use that term very loosely because people will define it in strange ways. But there seems to be a whole cult of people out there that think that there's ingrained human behavioral forces that sort of serve like possession modules, like someone kills somebody, they're just bad. You know, you hear that rhetoric throughout the years, oh, he's just a bad person, as though there was such a thing. Once you realize that we're conditioned into our mental apparatus and our worldviews, that type of argument really goes out the window. And I have some sociologists and some anthropologists that I'm going to be speaking with that can show through many different studies, not only in human but non-human primates, that this pattern of conditioning is extremely prevalent, and it's the society that creates the murderers, it's the society that creates the greedy mentalities, it's the society that's doing this. And I think that once people understand that thoroughly, then there'll be a basis for more dialogue, and people will have less cynicism. But sadly, I get so many people emailing me and contacting me with arguments that are so ignorant in regard to what high science and what modern sociological and psychological experiments have proven, that I don't even know how to orchestrate responding to them. So this film is going to be that response, and ultimately it's going to prove all the attributes of what I guess what you call a resource-based economy, which is what we're looking for, what we're working towards. I'm not going to spend too much time on the monetary system. I've done my share with that. I'll probably go into the free market a bit, generally speaking, to show the parasitic and paralyzing nature of the system. I'm also going to use examples probably of indigenous cultures that live without money, that actually live in what you call a resource-based economy already, but they're considered primitive, you know, and we don't recognize them, but there's the civil nature of their societies will become very prevalent. If you meet a culture that doesn't even know what warfare is, you know, that's a profound disposition which really blows out of the water a lot of our Western ideals of what the human being is inherently, as if there was such a thing. So that's a general summation. I'm still putting this stuff together, but there's going to be definitely a massive work. It might even be two DVDs long. I'm not quite sure, depending on how the content unfolds.
Okay. You brought up an interesting point about indigenous cultures, and one of the things that I found out in my research that is kind of systematically eliminated from our study about the American Revolution is the influence that the people who were here, the indigenous people, had on the Constitution itself. Matter of fact, there were representatives of what was called the Iroquois, or the Five Nations, from the upper New York State and Canadian area. If anyone takes a look at it, there's actually the people of the Haudenosaunee people, the Six Nations, are actually not United States citizens. They actually have their own passports, and they are separate from the United States. And their history is very interesting. There's a book called Exiled in the Land of the Free that you can look up on the internet, and you can find out more about that. It's got a lot of historical documentation and essays by historians of different universities around the country. And I find it interesting that this whole idea that our idea of democracy that most people that we learn in school think came from Greece or Rome or places like that actually didn't. It actually, there's a lot of historical evidence to the fact that Franklin met with the elders from these Indian tribes, and that they were present at the Philadelphia and the Continental Congress, and they actually were speakers there. So there's a whole part of history, for example, that, you know, that, I mean, I'm teaching my kids in school. I have two teenagers now. And after they come back and, you know, tell me about what they're learning in history, I go out, pull a few books out, and I say, okay, here's what they're not telling you. So one of the things that we can all do as parents is, and as individuals, is the things that we have found out is to share our knowledge with each other. You spend a tremendous amount of time explaining to people and educating people about what's going on with the monetary system. But one of the things that we, I think, as individuals need to do is share it with the next generation, because that information, that what we've learned and the small amount of wisdom that we've gained, needs to be passed on. And in these indigenous cultures, they had a mandate in the tribe to pass on their wisdom. And what I see happening in culture today is this is not happening in our westernized society. So I think that one of the things that we all can do is make an effort to not only our own children, but other children. Is that something that you feel would be helpful to, you know, create a transitional point for us to get to something like what Jacques Fresco is imagining?
Well, I couldn't agree more. I'm not quite sure as far as, education and the transfer of information is what it's all about. I mean, if people don't have access to relevant information and a relevant education, a thorough education, as you denote, then we're not doing, you know, society's not doing its job. The biggest tenets is getting people to be as intelligent as possible in a new system, because the more intelligent and aware they are, the more they can contribute to society. And unfortunately, in our current system, people are deliberately dumbed down. They are deliberately kept ignorant, because that's how the state maintains control. And that's how that's how corporations also maintain control and maintain their profit margin. It's really nasty when you begin to realize how people are not growing in intelligence in America, and this has been shown statistically at all. It's truly sad. But in a new society, and yes, I completely agree with you, education is going to be absolutely the most important aspect in many ways, because, again, that's how people contribute to society. If you have one person who has an idea, they should share it with the entire culture, because more minds are better than one. In our current culture now, we have patents. You know, we have these mini monopolies that are set up. You know, the free market's really a joke when you look at how monopolistic it all is. It's not. It's based on the search for monopoly. It pretends not to be.
Well, but, Peter, I have to stop you there. We've come to the end of our program today. I really appreciate you joining us today and sharing your wisdom with us through Zeitgeist and Zeitgeist Addendum. And if you'd like to find out more, of course, you can go to zeitgeistmovie.com, and you can go to the Zeitgeist Movement website as well. And I would recommend basically becoming a part of this new movement that Peter has created with us. Thank you for your courage and being a filmmaker and a visionary in our modern times. I very much appreciate the courage that you took to make these films and that you are continuing with it. Thanks for being with us today, Peter.
Thank you very much, Randall. I really appreciate you having me on.
Well, everyone, that's a wrap for our show for this week. And join us again next week as we showcase the very best in movie entertainment that inspires us towards positive change and honors the belief that simple choices can change the world. Thanks to our engineers. And, of course, if you want to find out more about the films we talk about each week, you can go to my website at spiritoffilm.net. And remember, you are the writer, producer, director, and star of your own movie that's called Your Life. So make it a blockbuster, and it'll be a classic. Until next time, I'm Randall Libero for Spirit of Film Conversations. We'll see you next week.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program brought to you on the Seventh Wave Network. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit SeventhWaveNetwork.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit VoiceAmerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.